Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. There's an extraordinary story on the front of the Sunday Times. John Mooney has been doing these stories for a while, and you read them initially, sometimes you think this sounds like the stuff of fiction or John le Carré or something, but they do turn out to be true. So, revealed, Putin has an agent in the Oireachtas. Irish politician's ego meant he let himself be used. And you're curious, and we will tell you all about it in a minute. Business Post is leading with an interview with Simon Harris. Not boom and bust, he said. Taoiseach rejects stinging budget criticism. There's a couple of interesting little lines in there as well. He thinks the Dublin airport cap is madness, he says, for an island nation. He also says he wants housing targets revised before he calls an election. So people will be reading tea leaves on that kind of thing as to what that means for the timing of an election. The Sunday Independent has a poll, and they're saying that the people have spoken. Nation wants an election next month. So more than half the public want a general election before the end of November, according to this poll. And indeed, in a separate question, they say they don't believe the government, but they say that they do expect them to have an election as well, and that they don't see it. It seems people will have no problem if there's a sharp U-turn about when an election is. Also, not good in this poll for the budget. 71% agree with IFAC that it was a boom and busty kind of budget and put the country at risk, etc. The Irish Mail on Sunday: Gardaí raised threat level for ministers. So cabinet informed that security risk is now at highest level ahead of election, and more discussion in that piece about the prospect of the Taoiseach moving into the Phoenix Park, into the Farmley. The Sunday Mirror and The Sun are both dealing with that story you were hearing more about on the news there. The murder of the man in Clover Hill prison. And the Sunday World is leading with a cocaine kingpin, as they call him, who's returning to Ireland to set up a new business following a UK prison sentence. Okay, our panel this morning: Oisín Coughlan is Chief Executive of Friends of the Earth. Alison O'Connor is a columnist for the Sunday Times. Scott Lucas is Professor of US and International Politics at the Clinton Institute in UCD. And Mary Hanafin is a former Fianna Fáil minister and a barrister at law. Good morning, everybody.
Morning, Brendan.
Alison O'Connor, tell me about Putin's agent in the Oireachtas.
Well, first thing I'd say is today is buy a paper. There is so much news, but this one beats Banagher, as they say. It's John Mooney, who, as you say, has a really stellar record for coming up with some extraordinary stories. So John is writing this morning that that Irish military and security services identified a politician in the Oireachtas. Now, there's a line at the top of the story that says Irish politician's ego means he's let himself be used. So that doesn't really narrow the field too much.
So we know it was a man, and one of those unusual men who has a healthy ego. Okay,
yeah, I couldn't possibly comment, Brendan. So they're calling the agent Cobalt for obvious reasons, you know, not to identify the politician. And the story goes on to explain that Sergei Prokopyev, apologise for my pronunciation there, who was a Russian spy who worked as a counsellor at the Russian embassy in Dublin from 2019 to 2022. And he was in charge of intelligence operations, and he recruited the politician. And the alarm was raised after the two men met outside Dublin and their conversation was monitored. And it's understood that this was at a time when... So the politician, the parliamentarian, is supposed to have offered to help establish connections with paramilitaries in Northern Ireland at a sensitive time during the Brexit talks. Now, this is despite that said politician not having any known public or private political engagement with the paramilitaries during his career. And the rest of it goes on, as you would expect, where there's possibility that this politician, Cobalt, may have been personally compromised or his internet history intercepted during travels abroad. And then you've the added bit where, as you say, you feel you're venturing into John le Carré territory. As part of the operation, the Russians are understood to have used a honeypot, an agent who seeks to entangle a target romantically, to meet Cobalt discreetly on numerous occasions in Dublin. So I suppose I mean, it did make me laugh when I read it this morning, yet it's obviously serious. And I suppose there is a naivety in us thinking that this sort of thing wouldn't happen
here. This is
here.
Yeah, yeah. This is the kind of stuff that goes on elsewhere and sure nobody cares about us. And Scott, does this all sound ring true to you?
Oh, it rings more than true, and there'll be more to come. And I say that for two reasons. The first is, since 2014, when the Russians got the jitters over Ukraine because of the People's Revolution there, their counterattack has been to try to unsettle European governments and the U.S. We know this a lot through the election interference that takes place, but they go beyond that. And they actually look for politicians and leading figures to disrupt societies, to raise divisive issues. Now, it so happened in this case, the divisive issue the Russians were looking at was the turmoil over Brexit and the relations between Ireland, the North, and the UK. And they found somebody to do their work for them, just as they found people on both the hard right and the hard left in Germany, and as they found politicians in Italy as well. So there's this wider context that...
And it's about just general chaos, yeah?
Yeah. To cause instability.
Yeah. There'll be do you think, is a lot of the chaotic stuff that we... The world does appear to have become more chaotic. The online sphere has become more chaotic. Is a lot of that down to Russian interference and bad state actors, do you think?
I wouldn't say the Russians necessarily cause this. We've got issues that always lead to, you know, you think about in recent months here about immigration, about housing, et cetera. But the Russians exploit that. And the Russians exploit it with voices who will not talk about finding consensus and finding solutions, but who will promote discord. And that brings me to the second reason, big point here, and it's a big question, is why now? Now, John Mooney's a great reporter, right? But somebody would have sort of led him to this story. And we can guess who might have within various services. And I suspect there's two reasons why they're doing this. First is there is a rising concern about these Russian operations, not just in Ireland, but across Europe. And there's cooperation to try to deal with these. And specifically, I suspect that the reason why the story comes out now is to put pressure on this Irish politician. Hasn't been named yet. No legal charges. But you really need to cooperate with us now to tell us how far this
Okay,
went.
They're smoking out cobalt. You've made it even more exciting. Mary Hannafin, are you shocked?
Well, on behalf of Oireachtas members, I have to say it's very worrying that the Russians were recruiting, quote, useful idiots. Right? They were identifying a vulnerable people who were vulnerable for money, ideology, coercion or ego. So why they chose to hit on the Oireachtas, I reckon it must be a senator because otherwise they'd have said it to the TD.
Oh, will you stop?
Otherwise they'd have said it to the TD. I think the basic story seems to be saying the Russians are watching us, but we're watching the Russians while they're watching us. So we know what you're up to. And John goes on to talk inside in the paper about the planning application that they put in for the new embassy in Orwell Road. And it was they got planning permission, but it was only when the Dunleary Town County Council looked at the plans and realised they were effectively building a whole new building the size of a house in the basement. And what was that for?
And it was kind of a utility room they were calling it.
Utility room,
along those
exactly.
Lines. Yeah.
So, okay, Russia, you might be watching us, but we're watching you too.
Okay. So this is a good news story.
I think it is interesting that it seems that from pretty early on, the Irish services were aware of this and were keeping an eye on it. So that's, I suppose, some good news. But you would wonder, you do find yourself wondering, what could an Irish senator or TD do to help the Russians? Yes, maybe spread some general chaos, but you'd wonder how useful they could be, even if they are ego-driven idiots. You mentioned John Le Carré. It more suggests to me the more recent take on all this, the Mick Herron, you know, the slow horses, where these spies are all these people who have made catastrophic mistakes and are put out to grass but end up being in the middle of international affairs in a way that has bad consequences.
Well, actually, I think it's unfair to call it slow horses now, in fairness. Like, I don't think we even have a real secret service in Ireland. But
I mean the person who's been recruited, not
ourselves. Oh, yes, I see what you're saying. Okay, anyway, we'll move on to other, I don't know, are they more important or less important issues at this stage? Mary Hannafin, were you at the Coir de Fáil dinner last night?
I was indeed.
So when's the election?
Well, it was quite funny, actually. It was absolutely jam-packed. Micheál Martin did every table in the room, photographs with everybody, great mood. Everybody knows an election coming. And when he said in his speech that the election will be in a couple of months, everybody laughed. Right? Nobody in the room believed him. You know, so he didn't say it's going to be November. He's sticking to his line. But I'd be amazed if it wasn't November. I mean, what government in their sane senses would wait for the bad weather of February and all of the problems that that
brings? Unless you thought that the bad weather of February and maybe the passage of time might take the gloss off your young counterpart a bit.
In fairness to Micheál Martin, I mean, I think he's a very serious politician, and he is very committed to government and to governing.
Yeah.
The question, though, is, and he has been saying that it's much more difficult to govern than to campaign. But how long can you keep governing when every time you go out, the question you're asked is, when is the election? You're not actually being asked about the policy issues.
By announcing that it won't be to February, by putting everyone out of their misery. They could do that. Like, I do think it's interesting. You mentioned one, Harris saying that he wants to do the housing and new targets for housing as well as the financial legislation. But also in that story about Micheál Martin at the Corda dinner last night, it points out that his minister, so to speak, Jack Chambers, controls the legislative timetable for the finance bill. So it's up to Fianna Fáil have to agree to speed up the finance bill if there's going to be an early election. And I think it was Gerard Howell in this studio a few weeks
Pascal
ago.
Pascal Donoghue is saying very clearly somewhere today, no, I forget, or yesterday, he said there has been no change in the timing.
No, although officials are preparing to do it faster. But I think the key point is, in order for the election to be sooner than after Christmas, they have to do something. They have to change the timetable of the legislation, and it isn't as simple as Simon Harris going to the Oireachtas. And so if they don't agree, or if they don't get around to talking about it for a little while longer, it actually becomes almost impossible to do it. So you wonder, will they get it together to have it before Christmas?
Yeah.
And the other thing is, they have an opportunity.
And that seemed to be part of, Micheál Martin was quite cranky, Alison, the other night at the Chamber of Commerce speech, wasn't he? And the big thing he was saying, and Pat Lee mentioned it again yesterday, there has been no conversation. And he was kind of saying, we haven't talked about this. And Pat Lee saying they need to have that chat.
I mean, listen, it's gone to the point of ridiculousness now. We're like, it's almost like we're trying to read the tea leaves. No, I'm actually sick of it. To me, what is going on here is one giant you-know-what contest. Begins with P, ends with G.
Yeah.
Won't say it on the radio.
Okay.
The young whippersnapper, who is, I think, getting a bit high on his own supply. He's done really well, but maybe getting a bit carried away with himself. And then you have the old dog for the hard road, whose fur is a bit ruffled. His own support has come down a bit. And the two of them are basically going at it and putting it up to each other. That's not really good politics. They're annoying the hell out of their colleagues from the cabinet table all the way down. And you're looking at the results of the Sunday Independent poll today, at which you read out, where people
are
saying...
By the way, I'll just say, so that we can continue to talk about it freely, it's a text-based poll conducted last Friday. Sample size was 1,413, let's put it that way. And the margin of error was plus or minus 2.7%. So, right.
So, I mean, I just think that at this point, it is interfering with the business of day-to-day. So you're talking about things that need to be done. Not a lot is getting done. We know that a lot of TDs are actually spending their time with their constituency canvassing rather than being at the Dáil, which to my mind is entirely understandable at this point in time. And that there are really, and all this kind of back and forth about it's the Taoiseach's prerogative. And I heard Simon Harris on News Talk on Friday, on one hand he'd be saying, I'll consult, on the other, it's my prerogative. It's a whole lot of macho posturing. Get over it.
I think they should put that to
her misery. Okay, and that's a great image you conjure. This is why we have you. But what does everyone want out of that peeing contest? Does Micheál Martin actually want to wait until February, or does he just want to be able to take the moral high ground when the election is called and say,
I think this is part of it. I think that ego on both parts has actually taken over maybe from pragmatism and good political sense. I mean, and the notion that we're hearing, and as I understand it, it's true, that they haven't had the conversation. Because, of course, when they have the conversation, they'll have to get down to the brass tacks. and they'll, you know, it's just the two of them. Obviously, it's Roderick O'Gorman as well, but most of this noise, if you like, has been between the two of them.
But I think the conversation is going to have to happen soon, because they have to make a decision about the finance bill. So it could be as soon as Monday night when the leaders meet that they have this conversation. And if they were taking any advice from me anyway, I would tell them to make a decision and just let us know.
And tell people.
Because the uncertainty they think is getting them some advantage. If it was at any point, it's not anymore. People are sick of it. I agree with Alison. And it has broken through that this is like the political pundits were saying no one cares and no one's paying attention. It'll be a one day story. But the uncertainty being dragging on has broken through to the general public. And I think they won't have much patience for it if it goes on, if that uncertainty goes on much longer.
So this and maybe that's when it's going to
Sorry, Mary. Yeah.
As soon as they say when it's going to be, then it's on. Right. So even though,
but it's on anyway.
Mary,
it's on anyway.
The front. I agree with you. But if you look at the front of Business Post,
let me just one second, Alison.
Sure.
No, I mean it's on for the candidates because they're all out anyway. Simon Harris apparently is in the United States on Wednesday, and the Dáil isn't sitting on Thursday. So there's very little work actually going to be done on legislation this week. They absolutely have to get the finance bill done, and they have to get the social welfare bill done. I've been government chief whip. You can do it in the night if you have to. It's not the way to do it, but it can actually be done very, very quickly. You can just guillotine as you go.
But I don't think the public would be up in arms if they came out next week and said, we're going to have the election on the 14th of February.
We're not dissolving the Dáil yet. We're going to continue doing our business.
The world wouldn't fall apart.
Sorry, Alison, you want to come back in there?
Mary and I are both sort of saying...
Seasoned.
God almighty, no, that wouldn't be a good idea.
Why not?
To have that length, because you literally would have nothing done.
All the bills that have to get passed would go through at the normal pace. Yeah. They would also finish the planning bill and the housing targets.
I'd defer, given Mary's experience of literally all of that as chief whip, I would defer to her on this answer.
I mean, the social welfare bill is very often done very quickly because some of it on the night of the budget in order to get the payments in.
The
finance bill takes a bit longer.
Talk about mental health legislation that he wants to get through. That's joint planning bill, the defamation, all
hugely important pieces of legislation
that could just be shoved through, they would fall,
but I mean they're the types of legislation that will come back in.
Planning bill, about which there is some issues, but that I would have for sure, it's 7 p.m. on Wednesday, it'll be done.
Scott, you wanted to come in there.
Yeah, I just very quickly, I mean, in addition to the young whippersnapper, the old dog, I'm also looking possibly at the dog that they're getting ready to shoot, who is Pascal Donohoe, who in the Sunday Times today is an absolute hit piece on him. Now, whether it's the
Donohoe who bows to Harris's big budget demands, Hugh O'Connell and Claire Scott,
which portrays him as being weak, and whether that came from the Taoiseach's office, whether it came from Fianna Fáil or from other parties, it portrays him as being weak in the face not only of his party colleagues, but in the face of the Greens, for example, who they claim leveraged him to get benefits. But I've got a wider point here, and it's sparked by Allison's excellent column.
I don't know if that piece is as extreme as him wanting to be taken out and be shot like a dog.
Well, I'm sure he wouldn't want to be, but I'm also thinking he's probably not very happy.
He wouldn't be thrilled about that piece for sure. Yeah. So it portrays him as a fading power.
Yeah, and the Business Post, by the way, who interviewed him, portrayed him as very tired. So it's not been a good day for him. But the wider point here, let's go beyond the personalities and so on. Allison's piece today in the Sunday Times talks a lot about the budget and whether it's showing economic and social responsibility in terms of short-termism, in terms of possibly fueling inflation. But all this talk we have about personality squabbling and so on, for me, raises the broader question of, are you showing responsibility on the issues that will be here in this election and beyond this election? You know, we should be talking about housing, et cetera. And here we are talking about personalities and ministers jockeying for positions.
We will talk about housing and all of that as well. But, this is all part of the stuff that impacts people's lives as well.
Mm. So can I just say on that Hugh O'Connell article, I thought it was very strange because he was talking about Pascal. He's hurt and he's disappointed and he's angered and he's frustrated. They're not the type of words that you would normally use in relation to a minister for finance on the week of a minister for public expenditure on the week of a budget. He seemed to be coming at it from a very, I don't know, soft, personal, emotional angle rather than the hard sense that you get.
Is there a sense that he's not the right-hand man of Simon Harris? the way he was of Leo Varadkar.
I think it's the sense that he's not the Minister for Finance.
Yeah.
I think that's the issue. Pascal was the Minister for Finance. He is no longer. He's the Minister for Public Expenditure, which is still a hugely important role, but it's not the Minister for Finance.
Okay,
yeah, I don't think there isn't that closeness. I think, I suppose, there hasn't been time for that to build up, but I don't necessarily think they would have been great buddies beforehand, Simon Harris and Pascal Donoghue. I think another way to look at the coverage this morning is, yes, Pascal Donoghue is no longer Minister for Finance, but it's also a way of, and we saw this earlier in the week, it's also a way of saying, and this picks up on what I was writing, that in years to come, hopefully this won't happen, but if we discover that this budget landed us back in our arses somewhat, you know, those of us who remember the from boom to bust previously, it will be on record how Pascal Donoghue wasn't happy, because you know, some of the coverage today is that, particularly last weekend, and in that as the... As
okay,
the,
so Pascal is not being sworn against here. He is letting it
depends
be known.
Depends on how
that,
you... Like, it, yeah, it depends, yeah, if okay. that happens. And I mean, let's face it, this sort of a bonanza, and by God it was a bonanza, is it, not what, really what his form.
What was a bonanza about it?
Well, if you think of that where were things at with the summer economic statement in terms of the one-off spending and all of that, and even the idea that we had a double payment, child allowance payment, and you still got the baby bounce for the Greens, which went right to the wire, that was agreed. It just showed that, I mean, again, it's the fact that you have a three-party.
It's the one-offs, is it?
Yeah, it's the fact that you have a three-party. And I mean, to call them, we need to find another word for calling them one-offs. They are no longer one-offs. And it's also this idea that people now, understandably, are going to come to expect that every year. It's this sort of engendered entitlement, yeah. And we need the help and we're entitled to the help and we look to the government for
they've
help.
They've become annual Christmas bonuses is what they've become, yeah. to the public.
And but if the government has too much of people's money, as the Taoiseach would say, why not give it back to people?
The problem is it's not only our taxpayers' money, it's also the windfall money from
no, it's
the...
Not.
Well, if you took all of those, if you stripped all those figures out, we'd be running a deficit. I thought the most more interesting analysis was.
But again, this week, and it was the government budget agency itself said this week that windfall is going nowhere until at least 2030. They're predicting. I think that.
No, it's. I thought that figure was. We could either end up with a huge surplus or a huge deficit, depending on how it went to 2030. It wasn't definitive that we'd keep having it till 2030. It was. If we keep having it, we'll have an 80 billion euro.
Yeah, but I think their prediction was that it'll be 37 billion corporation tax at that stage.
But both ministers acknowledged in their budget speeches that we are living in a very. What did Jack Chambers say? Was it incident or accident? Something prone world. I mean, yeah. We'll be talking about that
and
shortly,
And we're saving 6
yeah,
billion
but we're not
saving,
yeah.
We're not saving
we
the full the percentage
saving.
Compared to, say, what Norway put away from its windfall. And in Kevin Cunningham's analysis of the poll, He's Ireland
yeah.
Thinks, he asked people what they thought of the budget in one word, and the one he picks out was someone said 2007. Like, and there is that fear among those of us who remember that we could be getting into that. But the other part, just to build on
Which bit?
The level of spending and whether the level of spending.
Which of it was
well,
wrong.
That's the point. If I was to say one part, it is and this is what the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council said as well. It is the untargeted spending, particularly say the energy credits. The energy credits cost of giving every household, all 2 million households, 250 euro is 500 million euro is the cost of that. And as the Financial Advisory Council said, like that could have been put at targeted at lower income families who actually needed it at much lower cost.
Okay. Whereas so both you and Alison have identified it's the one-off universal.
Yes, well, the universal elements as well as the one-off. And what was really interesting in the ERSI analysis this week was that actually, if they just index-linked tax credits and social welfare payments 5 years ago, we'd have on average just been a little bit better off, and lower income people would be better off than they are, relatively speaking. So all of this razzmatazz, all of the smoke and daggers, and actually we'd have been better off with just index-linked payments.
Which would have involved the same level of tax cuts. The ESRI says that the cuts in the bans are barely making up for how much wages have increased.
I don't think that. Well, they wouldn't have had the one-off. You wouldn't have had the one-off payments. You wouldn't have had the same level of spin and razzmatazz and political clientelism.
The ESRI also said that that the danger of poverty, mainly out of this budget, was the cutbacks in the one-offs, we're in danger of putting older people and poorer people
into poverty. Yes, but the answer to that is to increase the core benefits, the ongoing core benefits, particularly the social welfare benefits that benefit those least well off, or extend the fuel allowance to those on working family payments. So you're building, and that would cost 80 million euros, as opposed to 500 for the energy credits. So you build in long-term support for those who need it, rather than annually giving money to everybody, half of us who don't need
Mary,
it.
Mary, what do you make of that? Because, like, the double-double child benefit does seem to be, when you ask people for an example of what was the profligate spending here, that's one of them. And it has been pointed out that there could have been a more targeted, there's a qualified child allowance that could have been increased more with that money, rather than giving it to a lot of people who possibly don't need it.
Okay, one of the big advantages of the one-off payments is that they don't go into the base of each department, which means you're able to respond to whatever the crisis is next year or the year after. Who would have thought that we were going to have to give energy credits a couple of years ago? It would have been unthinkable. Yes, you talk to any family with young children and you talk about the squeezed middle all the time, and the big issue that they all talk about is the cost of rearing children. The cost of childcare, the cost of having a child, the cost of it. So I think the child benefit is one of the great benefits. The universal argument is over. Right. We've gone through this.
It's
up,
not.
Down, round.
It's going on all week.
I know, but you can go up to it's particularly in relation to child benefit. It is absolutely impossible to do in a way that would ever be acceptable to society. We won't even go down that road.
But the ESRI did say as well, an opportunity missed to drag 40,000 children out of poverty by using that double-double in a different way.
So you don't have to tax the existing one or abolish the existing one and make the existing one means tested. You introduce with all this extra money a new one that only goes to those who need it. That I think you could do.
But the qualified child allowance did go up by 100 quid and the working family payment went up by 400 quid. And they also got the double month child benefit and the new baby bonus. So, I mean, all of that was directly targeted at families, and the free school, the hot dinners in every school, and every primary school in the country, and the free school books right up to Leaving Cert. I mean, they're all things.
Half those children don't need hot dinners at school, do they?
Well, there is an argument around not having stigma for those who need
Absolutely.
It by providing it for everybody.
Yeah.
Scott, you're observing all this.
I think my question to everybody here is that I think we're talking a lot about short-term one-off, and I can see merits on both sides of the argument for these. What I'm wondering here is, look, you've got long-term issues that we would all recognize here. And the question in this budget is, did the government show not only lip service in terms of the long-term challenges and the amount of expenditure that will be needed on them, whether we talk about housing, transport, education, healthcare? In other words, did they effectively set up a budget which you could look for 5 years, 10 years down the line, shows evidence of planning? Because that planning is going to be needed, if not now, very, very quickly, if only to throw in one thing from the Business Post today, which is the American Chamber of Commerce issuing a warning saying, if we do not see a significant turnaround in Irish infrastructure, we're worried that our folks, U.S. businesses, will no longer see Ireland as an attractive place to invest.
And we're using the AIB share money is going straight into water, energy, and a bit for the Land Development Agency for Housing. They have signalled kind of broadly that the Apple money will be going into infrastructure. Alison, you want to come back in there?
Yeah, I would like to start by saying, don't talk to me about the expense of children. I had a conversation with a teenager in the last few days about how the bank would think that she was blackmailing me. There is such a level of activity between my account and hers. But I mentioned in my column today about someone I know who has twins. And if you have twins, you actually get a payment and a half every month. So it's like for three children. Okay. Mm-hmm. I hadn't known that. And I could actually...
For long time.
I can really understand why you would need that at the start, very much so, not necessarily further on. But she is going to be getting 840 euros in all. And
Extra.
Needless, in total, with the double and the three kids and the double-double.
Okay, so three kids she's getting 420.
Yeah.
So for 2 months she will get 840.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's only until Christmas. She's not going to get it all next year. She's not going to get all those once-off payments next year.
It says a lot, Mary, that you need to clarify that at that level. Do you know what I'm saying? But
you made it sound like she was going to get it all the time.
Needless to say, she's thrilled. But she's also lived through the crash. And she said, like, she's a good job. Her husband's a good job. She doesn't need it. And I mean, I think if we go back then to the wider politics and what Scott was saying there, and this gets to the heart of the trouble that there is for the government going into this election in terms of people saying, recognising, I think, that there is all this money kind of sloshing around, that there's something maybe even a bit indecent about the level of money that's there. And yet the government having this really poor record on how careful they are at spending that money, and where Sinn Féin do manage to hit and get a sting when they talk about the government being serial wasters. And that, for me, is why the school pouch thing, another year that could have passed kind of okay, but I think it's emblematic of how sort of flahoolock the government has been seen and why that has been zoned in on.
Can I disagree on that one?
You can.
So, well, just first of all, I think while people don't trust politicians very much, I think I'm not sure I trust what people are saying about the budget either. I'll come to the school pouches in a second, because before the budget, they said they didn't want tax decreases, they wanted investment. And after the budget, while they're saying they think the government's done the wrong thing generally in the budget, or they don't trust the public finances, the thing they like most about the budget is the decrease in according to the poll, is the decrease
they
in income tax.
They hated USC.
Yes. Yeah. So,
and they, and they, and no, let's just say again, they did not get, people did not get a decrease in tax in terms of the changing of the point at which you go into.
I think tax credits should be indexed. Absolutely.
Yeah.
On the pouches, I mean, I think, first of all, obviously something that we can understand in terms of cost often comes up, because the budget in its entirety is 105 billion euros. And the increase this year is 10 billion. So those numbers are beyond most of our comprehension.
I was figuring out, if you take the, just for context, if you take the education budget,
it's 11 billion itself, I think.
Yeah. So it's less than a thousandth of 1%
yes,
of the education
so it's minuscule.
Budget.
And actually, I am with, Norma Foley has an op-ed in today's paper. I am entirely with Norma Foley on this. I think it is a good use of money. I don't know if it'll work perfectly, but at 9 billion, it's worth a shot, because the challenges that parents have with phones, and that schools have with phones, and the damage we know it's doing to children's attention spans and to their mental health, that yes, we're hearing there's an off button and schools have lockers, but it's up to every school and every set of teachers to figure out how to do it. And I think the idea where you can more or less say to your children, it's now the law, it won't be the law, but it's now the law, you've got to put your phone in the pouch, and it makes it so much simpler, so much more consistent for teachers and schools. We have these things, we have to use them. It's 20 quid per student to give a pouch to each school for each student that they will have, that the school owns. I think it's well worth it. And I think the opposition, who are flailing around looking for something to latch onto, have latched onto this. And I think they're wrong. And I think the Vox Pop show, there's the very mixed opinions among teachers
and
the public.
Vox Pops don't show anything. Vox Pops show...
What I mean is I don't think the opposition have found a populist stick to beat the government with by going against these pouches. I think they're good. They're worth a shot.
Does anyone disagree?
No, but I think we should look at this actually in the context of other articles which are in the paper today about mental health, about misogyny,
yes,
about young people and porn, about
Absolutely.
Aware saying that their calls are becoming much more distressed. I mean, everybody recognises that there is a serious mental health issue. We also recognise that the amount of time that young people are spending on their phones and on social media is contributing to this. When you talk about 9 million euro, and even when I heard it, I said, oh my God, 9 million euro on pouches. When you break that down to the 20 euro, and if you say to any parent, do you think the government should spend 20 quid on helping your child's short-sightedness, academic achievement, mm-hmm. socialisation, their sense of concentration? You say, of course, please, and spend an awful lot more. And yesterday on Colm O'Mungon's programme, Professor Matthew Sadlier, the psychiatrist, was on. He was absolutely outstanding. And he said, spend more of it. Spend more.
Richard Hogan is always been
do
on this show.
Do anything that will take young people away from their phones. And they have to be in these metal activation pouches and that, because otherwise they can be linked to their smart watches, they can be linked to their laptops,
they
can
hear,
be linked
they
to
hear
everything.
The buzz and get
they
distracted.
Hear the, and that they're sort of distracting.
There's a,
it's a good move.
Sinn Féin have a motion on this on Wednesday in the Dáil. Is that going to seem...
I think it's a real misjudgment.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I also think just generally where Sinn Féin is in trouble in relation to
okay, we'll come
this,
back.
Yeah.
We'll come back to that.
So
actually,
I think it's a wider
Let's not. Okay. Just before we go to the break, Alison, would you just tell us about the front page of the Mail? the Garda raised threat level for ministers. Does this seem like a serious kind of credible?
Yeah. This is a story by John Lee, and it is disturbing and unsurprising, I suppose, given what we've seen in recent times. And I mean, I know I've seen Met ministers on the street now where they are accompanied by a plainclothes guard. That would not have been the case before, but I think it's right and proper. So what the story in the Mail is saying that the security threat level to Taoiseach Simon Harris and cabinet members has escalated from moderate to substantial in advance of the general election campaign. I think that's wise. I think at the start when Simon Harris was first appointed, we saw what happened to him when he was in Mayo, even how close members of the Burke family got to him. I think that we just cannot. I know Irish politicians will say that it's very important for them to be able to interact.
Well, this is down to the exceptionalism that you talked about earlier as well, about the Russian thing, that, oh, sure, you know, we're different.
Yeah,
but
indeed.
The case everywhere else in the world
I
is
think
probably
we've,
that they
we've,
a lot
yeah,
of
exactly.
heads
we've
of
had
state
enough
live
evidence.
In certain houses and there is a lot of
But protection. I think you can. I still don't think. I think you can still have elements of that, but I'm very glad to hear that it's been taken very seriously and particularly within...
Because, of course,
there are also grants available for councillors and for politicians of that.
Which haven't been taken up hugely, those
I don't understand why, because a guard will come to your home, will look at it and will say, OK, you need a new bell, you need that back door changed. You may, depending on your status, need a personal alarm. And they will outline what you need for your own personal safety. And unfortunately, it has come to that.
Because those measures allow politicians to still have access to the public, that's in all our interests, actually.
Scott?
If there was a success rate, that could be worse.
It's regrettable that you have to talk about this, but... In 2016, someone who I knew, Joe Cox, who was an MP in the UK, a really outstanding person, just before the Brexit referendum was killed by an activist, a far right, a right-wing activist. David Amos was killed in his constituency. Again, and it's just the problem here is you want to maintain access between politicians and the public, but you have in this era we live in where tensions are whipped up by social media and by this attempt by others to cause division, some people will act out on it. So I think, I don't like sometimes the way the tabs elevate this and they actually contribute to the problem by giving this idea of hyperbole about the threat. But at a basic level, we need to be responsible.
Okay, let's take a break. Oisín Coughlan, Alison O'Connor, Scott Lucas and Mary Hanafin staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us, Oisín Coughlan, Alison O'Connor, Scott Lucas and Mary Hanafin. Now, Alison, you brought up Sinn Féin there before the break, but I just wanted to take a break because we want to not rush this now. But can you outline for us, without getting too lost in detail here, the trouble that Sinn Féin is in at the moment?
Okay. The headline of this piece by Adrian Rutherford says Sinn Féin was aware a year ago paedophile had got references. That's from the party. So the party press officer, Michael McMonagall, was first arrested in 2021, August. OK, and he was then suspended the following day.
And he was arrested, accused of...
attempts to incite at least four children to sexual activity. And he's pleaded guilty to those. He's awaiting sentencing.
Okay.
So the main line in this piece is that phones and computers that were registered to Sinn Féin were seized by the PSNI as part of that investigation the next day, right? So then we go forward to September 2022 and... McMonagall got a job with the British Heart Foundation, which led him to occasionally working with children, right? And then that he was provided with references for that job. This is the nub of it, by two senior Sinn Féin officials. And this was despite the party knowing that he was the subject of an investigation. So you roll forward then to what happened yesterday and what we heard, the development in it, and that means this really is a developing issue for Sinn Féin, that the British Heart Foundation revealed that in August last year, it made contact with a senior Sinn Féin human resources official. That person has since left the party, and that the person from the British Heart Foundation told the HR person it had received the two references from the party and that those had helped Michael McMonagall get that job. And you, in the British Heart Foundation, you mentioned
Sinn Féin are denying still that at a party level or a corporate level, which is a word they have used a lot in the past about these things. There was no awareness there.
No, and Michelle O'Neill, who has expressed great contrition on it, is saying that when he was at Stormont, McMonagall was in Stormont at a function and standing very near her
last year,
she did not see him. And then in the Mail on Sunday, John Dennan is writing at the Corge of Fall dinner last night, which Mary mentioned earlier, that in his speech, the Taoiseach to Micheál Martin said that he didn't believe any other party on this island would behave in the same way that Sinn Féin has in the face of profoundly serious questions about a former employee charged with terrible crimes. And I'll finish on the fact that it's worth looking at Maria Cahill's column, where she's basically, the poor woman is saying, I'm 10 years in from telling my truth, and basically that, like, when will Sinn Féin learn and when will they tell the full truth? I'm sure other panellists have read that as well.
Yeah, and she
and this is I will
that the child protection practices in her time were far from best practice.
Yeah,
and it seemed that this was not best practice.
And this is not good.
Alison,
in the week of the budget.
How bad is this?
Yeah, this is gaining legs, right? This is not good. And how do you defend this? And as Maria Cahill points out, when you look at Sinn Féin's history, when you look at cases like involving Liam Adams, when you look at Paddy McGahan, when you look at how Gerry Adams, the former party leader, how Mary Lou MacDonald very much stood by him throughout all of that.
And Gerry Adams, aware for a long time of his brother Liam Adams.
There is an awful lot of messiness in here. There is an awful lot. And it's something people understand very easily nowadays. Somebody who has been charged with these sort of crimes, everyone knows. You don't have to have done a training course or anything like that. Everyone knows what you do in that instance, and that you protect children, you inform, you go, you know, and particularly the political party with Sinn Féin's history in this area should be not only be, you know, be doing it, but be seen to do it.
OK, but that I suppose like the party, the Michelle O'Neills of the world, Mary Lou MacDonald, that is probably separate from the apparatus of the party, HR manager, etc.
Yeah, so but I guess, Brendan, if it was...
It didn't percolate.
It was the board of a charity.
Yeah, but if you were to talk about, you know, any other organisation who had been through what they've been through, you'd have maybe a round table where you'd be saying, listen, if there's a whiff of anything like this, it goes all the way to the top.
Mary Hannafin?
This is not a story about references. This is a story about child abuse. And it's a story about who knew what and why didn't they do more to protect children anywhere. And Maria Cahill's article is really very, very good. And obviously she's coming from her own personal perspective as well. But she kind of asks basic questions at the end of her piece. She has about 10 questions where she says, who knew? Who knew what? When did they know? Where is Mary Lou now? Micheál Martin asked that same question last night. Mary Lou has gone to ground on it for the last week. Michelle O'Neill is contradicting Mary Lou about who knew what, right?
Okay.
He's asking the question, were the devices looked at in the Sinn Féin office? So how could anybody or any party stand over, having the person like that on their staff, not checking the devices, and then two other members of staff giving a reference for him to go to work in a charity when they knew? It's not that they didn't
know. You say they knew, though, let's be very careful here, that they did not know about the references until it came up in the last week.
But even that's
in
the contradiction.
When the party did find out about it, they instantly got rid of the two men involved.
Yeah, but Mary Lou was saying, Michelle O'Neill was saying that they knew, had been contacted 14 months ago. And Mary Lou was saying that it was only the week before last that Sinn Féin became became aware of it. So, I mean, there's contradictions within the party themselves
which
is very worrying.
Does it seem, Oisin, as if there needs to be a comprehensive timeline and statement given by maybe Mary Lou MacDonald down here? Because there have been a few attempts to intervene here, Conor Murphy saying on Tuesday that Sinn Féin couldn't tell the British Heart Foundation, which because it would be prejudicial. And on Thursday, the chief constable of the PSNI said, well, no, that wouldn't be the case.
They could have refused to give references. I think you don't have to give a reference, or you could give a very, you know, I think at the very least, this is a major failure of HR and obviously more importantly of child safeguarding by the Sinn Féin infrastructure. We don't know exactly when the political leaders knew what, but just from learning the lessons of the past, and Maria Cahill's article is really powerful, but just more generally, the longer the leadership of an organisation tries to avoid these issues or tries to avoid transparency and accountability, the worse it gets for them. So purely from their own strategy, Mary Lee McDonald should be out there and do one of these press conferences where you answer all the questions to the very end, hope you can satisfy it, but at least drain the scandal from it, because otherwise it's just going to fester and fester.
Yeah, okay. And like, clarity is what is needed here. There is no suggestion of anyone doing anything wrong.
And I suppose what's not needed
is
letters threatening defamation from Mary Lou MacDonald from people who are just merely discussing the case.
So just briefly, Alison, next week there is going to be an attempt to
the wording of that yet. But as I was saying, it clearly is it's tricky territory for Sinn Féin.
Okay. Scott, where are we at in the Middle East this weekend? I mean, watching the coverage the last couple of days, there's two things that would strike me. One is that you hear Israelis saying, oh, we're only a kilometre and a half in there, and, you know, there are tunnels there. They were planning on October 7th. We're just going to nip that in the bud, and then we're going to get out. And then you look at footage and you think, is this Gaza all over again? And then the second question, is there something kind of starting to bubble up here that some question of an opportunity for kind of, well, you don't want to say regime change, but like that people might be thinking, oh, we could reshape the Middle East. There's an opportunity here.
There's certainly certain elements amongst the Iranian diaspora and what you might call the U.S. hardliners about talking about regime change in Iran. That, first of all, doesn't reflect the complex realities of what happens inside Iran, where a lot of people are unhappy with the regime, but they don't want to be seen as serving the West and overthrowing it. And it doesn't help in terms of, it will stoke further possibilities of Israel-Iran confrontation. Getting back to the fundamentals, what has happened in the last few weeks is that we have a two-front war now, which is not just with the 42,000 killed in Gaza as we mark the one-year anniversary following, it must be said, Hamas's own mass killings inside Israel. We now have thousands who have been killed in Lebanon in the past couple of weeks, and hundreds of thousands injured, because remember, it started with the pager attacks, then the walkie-talkie attacks, and then the targeted assassinations, including Hezbollah's leader, and then, as you mentioned, the ground invasion. Without going into the whole history about how Israel has come a cropper in terms of its previous ground invasions, going back to 1978.
Lebanon is often known as Israel's Vietnam.
78, 82, arguably 96, 2006. I will give you the fundamental we could discuss, and that is, this only stops when the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu decides he wants it to stop. The reason why this
is America now completely powerless? Is Netanyahu just ignoring America at this point? Or is Biden too weak to try and do anything?
Oisin's right, because the U.S. tied its hands behind its back. It could have done two things within the past year at any point. It could have come out and at least limited, if not halted, military aid to Israel, which is being used in those attacks, and it could have called for an unconditional ceasefire. It chose not to do so, and that gave Netanyahu the breathing space. But here's the kicker to the tale, why Netanyahu decided to go for a second front in Lebanon. The pressure against Netanyahu was coming from inside Israel. Mm-hmm. You had hundreds of thousands who were protesting and saying, you're not getting these 100 hostages, dead or alive, back. There seems to be no end to your forever war.
He says, look over here instead.
Yeah, exactly.
And now he's riding high.
It's a massive distraction in a way, and in that he hadn't fulfilled either of his war aims in Gaza. He hadn't dismantled Hamas, although he damaged them. And he hadn't get the hostages back. And he goes, obviously they had been developing their plans as to how to tackle Hezbollah, and they've executed them very well, shall we say, from their point of view. But they haven't. They've now got a multi-front war with no end in sight, and you know, the possibility of a full-scale confrontation with a nuclear-powered state in Iran.
And Scott, so for America failing to kind of nip this in the bud so far, is it an exaggeration to say that this could turn into a situation where America gets drawn in to a conflict with Iran, Russia then gets drawn in on the Iranian side, and that this turns into like a major conflagration? Or is
I don't think that's the immediate prospect. And while having no loss for the Iran regime, what they did by firing those 181 missiles into Israel last week was largely a demonstration. Mm. They did damage one Israeli airbase, but they told Arab states 24 hours in advance that the missiles were going to fly in. So the Arab states would tell the U.S., who told Israel. Iran doesn't want that confrontation because they're outgunned by the Israelis.
Okay. Do the Israelis want it?
Well,
maybe. What, head on, like,
not really, but Netanyahu might. He has in the past. But here's what Iran's attack, the Iranian supreme leader, by ordering that attack, helped Benjamin Netanyahu. He helped Netanyahu not by bringing up an Israel-Iran confrontation, but by giving Netanyahu more breathing space regarding Lebanon and Gaza, because he can turn around to those people who've been protesting him and say, we now are at risk in Gaza, in Lebanon, at risk from Iran. Do you really want to get rid of me? Because one other thing.
I am the protector of Israel, and this is the classic situation where we are surrounded by people who want to annihilate us now. He's actually managed to almost have a hand in creating
But
that
he
dynamic.
Has the one who's escalated. Neither Iran nor Hezbollah actually escalated in any significant
Hezbollah
fashion.
Hezbollah have been firing rockets into Israel every day since October 8th last year.
And not in any way defending what they've been doing. But they haven't sought, and all the Scott can speak to this more, but are that they are kind of doing what they have to be seen to be doing by their own calculations, but not seeking escalation. He is the one who escalated.
But there are 600,000 Israelis can't live in the north part of Israel because of the rockets being fired in every day. Correct?
Yeah, I thought it was 60,000.
Sorry, 60,000.
And that's still serious.
Yes.
But the immediate point is that you did have what we'd call low-intensity conflict. I hate the term, but what it is, which is Israel had killed more than 350 Hezbollah members and 100 civilians. Hezbollah had killed 22 Israeli soldiers, 26 civilians. Let me give you the stinger of all of this. It was being teased just a couple of weeks ago that Netanyahu was going to get rid of his defense minister, Yoav Gallant. And that's because Yoav Gallant was privately criticizing the operation in Gaza as not having an end in sight. A day later was the Patriot attacks, because Yoav Gallant and the military do favor expanding operations in Lebanon. So whatever we think of what was going on between Israel and Hezbollah, Netanyahu not only saved himself from the Israeli public, he saved himself from a split with his military by going for that second front.
Okay, so as much as it might all seem chaotic and escalatory and crazy, it's all highly strategic by him. Okay, to take a break.
What about if we should really mention Camp Shamrock, and we should mention the Irish soldiers? President Higgins coming out yesterday and kind of criticising Israel, saying, pull back. I mean, there's a human interest story here as well for Irish peacekeepers who were well recognised throughout UNIFIL for many, many years. The only army that have served every single year since the establishment of the United Nations. And yet here they are, there's a lovely inverted commas story by Valerie Hanley in the Mail on Sunday, who talks about the human interest side of this.
The vignette of the conditions.
The conditions,
in the outpost,
the water and food supplies are running low. For 2 weeks, they've had no supply trucks. They're waiting days for one and a half minute
This is not in Camp
hour.
Shamrock, I think. They this are is eight, in the other
outpost. Sorry, beg your pardon. They're 18 hours in a bunker. Their families are here worried about them.
And look, not to worry their families too much. We are still assured all the time by the Taoiseach Minister of Defence and the top brass of the army that they have enough
absolutely, and they're in
and
touch with them
enough.
All the time.
They're eating into their reserves at this stage, but they have enough for a month.
But isn't it even the idea, we're talking about phones earlier, that Wi-Fi is down, which I think is just so appalling for their families and for them. But if I could for a minute, Brendan, on this
briefly,
this intervention from President Higgins saying it was outrageous and an insult that the Israelis had threatened them. I mean, really, to me, President Higgins at this stage is going from figurehead to loose cannon. You know, he's gone so off the constitutional reservation now that, I mean, is he in the ORIS or is he in the Department of Foreign Affairs? I think it's becoming quite a dangerous situation. And I think it's interesting to note that
most people will not condemn him for that.
Yeah, but that's he's speaking as commander-in-chief of the defence forces.
Most
people would support that.
Yeah, but does that make it right? Does that make what he's constitutionally, what he is supposed to do? To me, I look at, he is 83, President Biden is 81. You wouldn't normally make comparisons because normally the Irish president is a figurehead. Michael D goes and continues to go far beyond that. And okay. It's the job of the government and foreign affairs to have interactions with the Israelis. It is not the job of Michael D. Higgins.
He was now going out practically weekly.
Yeah. Okay, I have to take a break. Oisín Coughlan, Alison O'Connor, Scott Lucas and Mary Hannafin staying with us.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel is still here. Mary Hannafin, did you know Mary O'Rourke well?
Of course, for a very, very long time, and God rest her, my sympathies to Angus and to Fergal, head to Athlone today. People have talked a lot about Mary O'Rourke. When you're the only woman in a cabinet with 15 men, you are going to be a powerhouse, and you need to be a powerhouse, and she absolutely was.
And she never used the excuse of being a woman,
In fact, she hated that. Yeah. She hated any idea that she was there because she was a woman, that anybody like her should be appointed because of gender, didn't want to be Minister for Women's Affairs, insisted on having kind of high, powerful roles, which she held. One of the things I loved most about her was the way she stood up to Albert Reynolds. He was purging his cabinet. By God, Mary O'Rourke was not going. And he was forced to appoint her as a junior minister. And 2 years later, she was back in the cabinet. You know, she saw the big picture. And the other thing that I love about her, because politicians, all of us, lead very public lives, you keep your private life private. And Mary shared her private life when she came out of politics. She shared her grief with Enda. She went on then talking about literature.
But all in an effort to be useful to people, you know.
She endeared herself to a whole new generation of people, absolutely. And the world got to know her.
Absolutely.
And God rest her.
I don't think we'll have politicians like that anymore, the way the world is now. Okay, thanks very much to my excellent panel. I could have kept going with you for another hour. Oisín Coughlan, Alison O'Connor, Scott Lucas, Mary Hannafin. And I'm sorry we didn't get to Bantry, Alison, your hometown,
Bantry,
but our thoughts are with them all today.
Thank you.
I have to go to